Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm Poke Runyon, and so are you. Tonight we present a report on the August 2nd Farfarian Lunisod, or Lammas, ceremony that Sir Zandria and Frater Thavion attended as guests of Lady Jo Carson, Avatrix of Farfaria, and her husband John. They presented this at their woodland-surrounded home north of San Francisco, California. The Lunisod ceremony is described in Fred Adams' Nine Royal Passions of the Year as the festival of fruiting and the beginning of harvest, the meanderings of the honeymoon as fruits in scented groves ripen, the breasts of the goddess swell. Our special guest will be Lady Jo herself, who will give us a more profound and intimate description of the event in its idyllic forest setting. Farfaria is the oldest, the most elegant and sublime expression of American neo-pagan goddess-centered nature religion. And if you're new to this tradition, or if you are already attuned to its enchantment, then be sure to join us. And Lady Jo will be calling in very shortly. And before she does, I want to say that we had an absolutely enchanted time up there north of San Francisco in that beautiful, beautiful, idyllic woodland setting. They have their houses. It reminds me so much of Ishtar House in Pasadena, where Fred and Svetlana, when I first met them, back when I was way back in 1970, I believe, when I first met them, and I thought that I had gone through a time warp and that I was meeting the priestess of Ishtar and her consort who was an elven druid, and it was just I have to admit that I had started, you know, I had my revelation, of course, and I've been trying to find somebody in Los Angeles who you might call a hermetic master, you know, and I couldn't find anybody. The Hollywood Sunset Strip magicians were, well, sort of underwhelming, and I complained to one of my Wicca friends, and I said I just can't find anybody that's a real master to study with, and she said, she was a Russian lady, and she said, oh, I have a friend of mine, Svetlana, her husband is very, very, very much of a scholar and a magician, and I will take you out and I will introduce you. And of course, when I walked into that house in Pasadena, it was a modest bungalow, but they had just transformed it into a fairyland. And I walked in and we entered the house with my friend Rita, and we in this absolutely gorgeous, a woman came in wearing kind of gossamer veils and made up like a magnificent Grecian high priestess, and she swept into the room and she said, "I am Svetlana. Welcome to Feriferia." And then of course Fred came out, and he was, like I said, he was like one of the elves. Lady Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Well, I was just going to say that the Master Fred came out, and he was like something out of the Lord of the Rings, one of the elves, you know. I thought at this point, I finally found what I'm looking for. So I'll turn it over to you and tell us about the ceremony that we really enjoyed up there, and just go ahead and give us the rundown on it, if you would.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you had such a good time. It was great having you all up here. I wanted to just sort of give a little orientation to what we were actually celebrating, which was a feast or ritual festival called Lammas, which is also called Lunasa. And Lammas means loaf mass, or the mass or ritual or celebration in a churchly way of the first loaf, which would be, you know, from the first harvest. Lunasa was for Lu, the sun king. It was the wake of Lu, and Lu had in the cycle of the sacred year been slain at the summer solstice. And so at Lammas or Lunasa time, they celebrated his wake. And the difference that we have in Feriferia, we celebrate this moment also, and it's the midpoint between the summer solstice and the fall equinox. And in Celtic traditions, those midpoints were really actually more powerful than the solstices and the equinoxes, because they seem to contain, as an origin of anything does, the essence of the season to come. So it wasn't just some random day that was picked out of nowhere. It was really, you know, the beginning and thus the essence of each coming season. So although Lammas is technically still within summer for us, it has all the new beginnings, the feelings of fall to come. So, and there are people who say that actually the Catholic Church changed our orientation on their calendar in order to lower the importance of pagan holidays in the minds of the people. So they reoriented the calendar to say that fall and begins with fall equinox and spring begins with equinox and so on with the seasons. But the reality was that the pagans actually used to celebrate the cross quarters as the initiation of the seasons. So with that in mind, the question, well, what are we doing besides celebrating the beginning of fall, maybe, or the birth of it? In Feriferia, what we're doing is the story is that the magic maiden, who is the earth, right? We're talking about Gaia, the earth goddess, whose heavenly throne is the moon, as her partner's heavenly throne is the sun. So she gave birth in the springtime. Her male child grew up very quickly. They enjoyed Beltane together, where they became engaged. At the summer solstice, they were married and had their first sexual union. And so our celebration of Lunasa or Lammas is that they're on their honeymoon. So he hasn't been violently killed. We don't have an annual cycle that includes a lot of, you know, killing and violence. It's much more rooted in nature, as in the plants are all pollinating at the summer solstice time, and now things are starting to develop into being pregnant with, you know, a new life. And so the goddess is seen now as being impregnated also. And so that's really the essence of this this rite or feast. We have a moment where they're celebrating their honeymoon. They need to have the deep instruction of, you know, what is the most important thing that a person might do or a couple might do on a honeymoon, is learn to really get to know each other sexually. You know, in Beltane time, we you know, the men to the men and the women to the women, you know, gave instruction in how to be, you know, how to be with each other, how to learn the initial things of sexuality and of being a human being in a relationship where you're holding your own center but still relating to the other. In this ritual, we're going further with that and going into sacred sexuality and tantra and chrysokhima, which was something that Fred developed. It's kind of a yoga and qigong approach, which involves an attainment much like the same similar goals to tantra of ecstatic sexuality, where you merge with the universe. So that's what we were up to here. It sounds like a kind of a mouthful, doesn't it?
Well, you know, we've been, Farfaria and the OTA have been alternating for years with Farfaria doing the cross quarters and the OTA does the quarters, the solstice, the equinoxes. And, of course, we traditionally kill off the Ear King in summer. Because we're following that solar cycle. And so it's very, very good complement. So you leave the leave that aspect of it to us, and this has worked out beautifully, I think, and that just really the synergy between the two systems, because Southern California is so much like ancient Phoenicia. The climate's the same and everything. But one of the things that I about Farfaria that I just dearly love and is that Fred was so attuned to landforms and all the different vegetation. We used to go out. Fred and I used to go out hiking, and Fred, he could identify every single plant. I mean, hundreds of them, and he knew them all, he even developed, as I'm sure you recall, the landform yoga, yoga of the, it was kind of a, and that was more based on feng shui than on the Taoist qigong thing, but he. And then Fred used to dance, do the Mongolian star dance, and dance the constellations. He was without a doubt one of the most supremely cultured magicians in the world. I mean, and Svetlana too. I mean, Svetlana, we're realizing, more and more now, they're both passed away, but we're realizing more and more how much she contributed,
right.
Once Farfaria really got started,
yes, I would say absolutely. Although I want to just mention, because you were mentioning his landform yoga, I was just recently, yesterday, really delving into an article he wrote called The Art of Enchantment, which he wrote in the late 60s, like 67 or maybe 66, so not that late. So it's a very, very old, article. It was written ages ago. The paper is delicate and thin on a hand typewriter. And this is a really well-worked-out system of, in a certain sense, similar to Franz Barden writes how you concentrate on something and then you start sharing consciousness with it and then you interiorize it and you become it and it becomes you and you start seeing the world through its eyes and you start animating it. He did that in spades. But not only just with objects like a pearl or an apple, but going beyond that to human beings and even further animals and even further hills and trees and then whole groupings of like a piece of land with a piece of water that was a tree next to it, a whole grouping where there was a spirit of place to the point where literally what the exercise, and it's very well worked out, what the exercise encompasses is that you lend your own consciousness and spirit into the spirit of place that's already indwelling there, and you become one with it. And you're amplifying that spirit by joining it with your consciousness. It's really profound, and I've never seen anything else like it.
And while we're on that subject, one of the things that I kept gently prodding Fred about as he was getting older and all, I kept saying, Fred, you have to get all this together, and you have to get it all together in a form that can be published, so the whole tradition can be preserved because of all of this. And he kept telling me, I'll do that. But then he would continue to create and create and create. His mind, and the same with Svetlana, his their minds were just continually in a process of ongoing creation in the in this beautiful tradition that so they didn't concentrate on so much on what they'd already done, except they just continued on and on and on and on and on. It was as if the wellsprings of creation could not be suppressed. It had to be they had to continue creating. And now that they both passed away, you have been doing just a marvelous job of getting this together and preserving it, which if it hadn't been for you, it probably would not have, that would not have happened. And it would have, well, as I think Margot Adler made the point, that Farfaria, when she encountered it, was like a wonderful jewel in a box.
And, yes, and up on a shelf where you could look at it from afar. Yeah. Right. She did say that in her book, and you know, there was some truth to that, and really the reason for that aspect of Farfaria was that Fred really felt, and Svetlana agreed with him, that our world was, you know, and kind of does seem to be headed in such a catastrophic way, environmentally speaking, that that it was quite possible that there would be some kind of, you know, environmental catastrophe, and that, you know, it might possibly go, and they were certainly hoping it wouldn't, but that it might possibly go in a direction where many, you know, much of humanity might be wiped out, and they would desperately need to have the solace of some spiritual connection with the earth that is, you know, so profound that this is basically they were creating a religion for the future. And that's why she said that, because it really did have that quality. I mean, they weren't making a huge effort to get it out at that time to a whole lot of people. And it was basically, the phrase came to my mind while you were talking, they were a fire hose of creativity. There was no stopping the creative juice that was coming through that pair. And, you know, and yet, you know, as you say, it wasn't getting out to a lot of people. And there's no way that knowing what was there that I could let that just, you know, die on a shelf somewhere and, you know, mold and turn into black rot. I cannot let that happen. It's way too important and valuable to our earth. Right now, where we're, right now we have so much environmental catastrophe going on. We need, you know, something to give us a way to relate to the earth in a more conscious way and more joyful way, so that we all stand to kind of put our lives down if necessary to protect it, you know, or do whatever we're capable of doing if it's not that extreme. And I kind of would pause at that too. Anyway, that was kind of a, you know, why I'm motivated to do this. You know, I just feel really strongly about it.
Well, it is certainly a very profound and spiritual motivation, because this is, as you say, this is a vision for the future when we can recover from what we're headed for, if in fact we are. And I have to agree. I have to agree that well, if you start doing the figures and all and looking at what's coming from a general systems theory aspect and all that, something has to happen to get this situation straightened out.
Yeah, to wake up to how alarming it really is.
Maybe it can be positive, but if it's negative, well, if that's what happens, then it happens. But we would prefer it to be positive.
Certainly. But I wanted
go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just hoping to kind of get back a little bit to our wonderful ritual, because the rituals are, you know, really positive, and you know, we're kind of getting into a sort of a scary area. And, you know, part of my personal thing is creating positive visions of the future that attract, and that's certainly much of what Fred was doing with something that I'll be bringing up a little bit later, is creating positive visions of the future and practical ones that one can, you know, enact right now to make a better future and to lay the groundwork for it. But our ritual that we did here, which was a tremendous amount of fun. I mean, basically, it was just a whole lot of fun. You know, we have a small stone circle here at our place, and we had a group of just almost 20 people, you know, sort of singing and dancing around the circle. But I thought it would be maybe of interest to your audience to let people hear just a little sample of the kind of language that is involved in this particular ritual. And I don't suppose that you happen to have at hand your evocation of Aphrodite that you did by any chance.
No, I did bring it home, but I don't think I have it with me. I wish you'd suggest
I happen to have
that
it in front of me. Okay.
You could. Why don't you do it? If you have it in front
I
of you,
I will do the whole thing because it's a real evocation. It kind of does go on a bit, but it has some amazing language of it. And so I'll just give a little flavor of it and skip over a few parts. So here, envision Poke up there, sonorous and, you know, with his booming and beautiful voice. And there's, you know, a kind of a little platform with veils and, you know, some flowers, you know, receding. Aphrodite, Venus, Astarte, Tenet, impassion our bodies, temporal, astral, and eternal with your intense voluptuousness. Infuse our bodies with your radiance of blessed sensuality. O beauteous one of flowering groves, orchards, and deciduous forests, the exuberant overflow of rainbow tapestries woven by your damsels of divine display, come, sacred butterfly, come with unlimited mercy, pollinate our beings with compassion and erotic love, come opulently, come lushly, you whose tingling caress unites proton and electron, male and female, species with species, planet with planet, galaxy with galaxy. Come, great cosmic courtesan of infinite sumptuousness and comfort without end. Let us partake of your bodily splendor. You get the general idea.
Yeah, it was really good.
And then what happened, Poe?
I tried to put that sort of in a in a masculine way, and because the lady that preceded me with her invocation, she sort of set the tone for that, and so I went ahead and put some, you know, put some enthusiasm into it from a male point of view.
Well, yeah.
But it was just an absolutely beautiful ceremony, and of course, the lady that took the part of Aphrodite was just devastatingly beautiful, and I thought the whole thing, the whole business was just terrific. One of the things I might mention just that one of John's friends brought an instrument which I had never heard before, and I hate to admit I never heard before, but it was he came in with a Schruti box, and this is a sort of like an accordion, and it's a very simplified version of a harmonium, and it produces a wonderful drone, and that drone. This is an Indian instrument, by the way, and so the drone is quite appropriate to Indian, hypnotic Indian music, and so some of the poetry that was delivered was with this wonderful drone behind it, and that elderly woman, I guess we could call her elderly.
Oh, she's a beautiful crone. Yes, she's wonderful.
Oh yeah. Well, I don't want to use that term, but she did a poem and with accompanied by the Schruti box, and it was really, really delightful. There was a hypnotic quality about the whole ceremony. I thought when we did the dance, the circle dance. And then this elderly lady, she took charge at the end of it, got us all together, and tightly encircled around the cauldron, and then she started, got us all humming, And we didn't even need the Shruti box at that point. We were all kind of swaying back and forth in this tight circle and humming and looking down at the cauldron. And this became such a transcendental. I mean, we literally, it was like creating a different, getting us into a different dimension.
This was
a new, yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of things
I saw the face of the goddess in the smoke in the cauldron, and I said, if you put a large mirror down there in the center, we would have all seen the goddess.
Well, there was a lot of warm heart feelings that were encouraged throughout the ritual, and one of the things that Aphrodite did, the role was played by Caradwyn, who was, I'm sure, fine with being mentioned by name, and she did a marvelous, as you say, marvelous job. She went to each participant and placed her hand on their body, like, you know, on their heart center, or maybe a shoulder, comforting gesture. Each person got the touch of Aphrodite at some point as she went from person to person, and there was a real magic about that. It was like you were being touched by the goddess. And, of course, it was also considered, the whole festival was considered an aphrodisia, which is to say a feast in honor of Aphrodite. So we kept bringing up that sort of sensual celebration of the, you know, sacred sexual element within the context of our fairly, you know, above board ritual there. We weren't having an orgy or anything like that, but we were definitely celebrating the erotic there.
Yeah, well, this is something that a lot of people don't understand about the, you know, pagan and Wiccan and even magical traditions. We symbolize and evoke this sort of thing, but it's, we don't, you know, we're not, We don't do what the Hollywood people think we do. I mean, you know, we evoke and invoke the spirit of it, and we find our ecstasies in dance and in these trance-inducing circles and very shamanic altered states of consciousness. So we don't really need to we don't need to do anything that's anybody would consider naughty. We don't need to. We can transcend the need for naughtiness. That sort of thing. The spirit, and you get more actually from a religious point of view. You really get more inspiration by this active symbolism of the impression, and one of the things about Farfaria is to try to extend this erotic feeling not just to each other but to nature itself. And to the sensuality of the hills and the trees it's a beautiful form of the love of yourself and each other and the environment and your home and your land and it's extending love, real love, not selfish love, not jealous love, but real open love to each other and relating that to nature around you. And I think that's what we need to. Well, I know you would agree with me. That literally would save the world if we could do that.
Yeah, you got that. Very well put.
Talk on. I'm dominating this end of the conversation.
That's all right. I'll say a few more things about the ritual, just because there were some really neat parts to it. Along with this wonderful appearance of Aphrodite, there were a few instructions, you might say, in the art of love that were initiated by the priest and priestess, and then we were able to actually encourage people who were present to, given, you know, instructions and advice and just, you know, what would come up from their heart in a spontaneous way to a couple who might be on a honeymoon. And so that actually got people quite involved. And then it was after that level that we did our wonderful circle dance that really was very powerful to Aphrodite, in honor of Aphrodite. And there was another moment that was really quite beautiful after we had some odes to Aphrodite and Adonis and the charge and charm of Lammas and those ones. There was a nice moment there where we gave, after giving honor to Aphrodite and Adonis, we had little statues of each of those on small pillars. Who we revealed at a certain point, and everybody had kind of brought out, as we processed into the circle, they were all, you know, had noisemakers, like little, you know, castanets and tambourines and, you know, rattles. So they were holding on to these, and whenever somebody said something especially profound or that they wanted to really, you know, chime in with, they could make some noise with their, you know, noisemakers, which was kind of cool to help people participate. But another thing that was just a really nice moment was that it's written into the ritual, and this was a ritual written by Svetlana, that there's a green liqueur for Aphrodite and a red liqueur for Adonis, and Adonis being sort of a phase of the Kouros, or the divine lover of Aphrodite, who's again related to Corey. And I know these are a lot of names, but anyway, we're celebrating the sacred year for Corey and Kouros, but we're also honoring individual divinities, a pair of divinities at each season too. So when we give the odes to them, then we reveal them, and then we served their liqueur to all of the participants. So those little bottles and cups of red and green liqueur went all the way around the circle, and everybody got to see that was getting poured and then drink them, and that put everybody in a good mood. You have your way there with your rituals there, Poke, with your Who Drinks With Me feast, the mead, and so this is one of the ways that we do something a little bit similar in our circle here. But
Svetlana was very, very much into color, into the aspect of color symbolism as applied to sacramental food, and
right.
and I remember, you know, she would say, tonight we are going to have nothing but purple food.
Oh, she did indeed. I couldn't go there. We had to have lasagna. What could I say?
Yeah,
we do usually have vegetarian feasts, so in Fairfair,
yeah.
I will say that. It's a very kind of the ahimsa thing, the harm, you know. She called it the golden diet, the golden feast. It was basically that it would be foods which really don't cause harm to speak of, hopefully, in their you know, production. So milk is always considered fine because, you know, it's given freely, like fruit is, and nuts and that kind of thing, berries. And so we had our vegetarian lasagna. Everybody brought food. It was a big feast. It was beautiful. Well, also just in terms of set and setting, we had little tiny colored lights, like, strung through the trees. We had a lot of grapes and ivy leaves strung up in the little archway over where the goddess appeared. And, you know, we had little candles and stuff here and there. So there was kind of as the twilight was coming on, it became more and more that, you know, the place itself became more magical in its feel. It felt really nice. Outdoor rituals are just the best, in my opinion.
It's beautiful. Yeah, absolutely beautiful. And I thought the lights, sort of like, almost like captured fireflies, and they were. It was really an enchanted environment, by the time the ceremony was over, we were all totally enchanted. I mean, we were all in an altered state by the time we finished the ceremony, that we continued that mellow exteriorized perception beyond ourselves continued through the evening. It was a totally realized and perfect event. I can't compliment you enough for the way you staged it and the way you had it organized and everything. It was really beautiful. Now, let's talk about, because, you know, we want to kind of get people aware of Ferroferia and make them more aware of what resources are available from it. And for those of you who haven't listened to our particular Ferroferian shows before, you should be aware that Lady Jo is a very, very talented filmmaker. And in fact, she even has a background in professional filmmaking. And I believe you worked for Lucas for a while. So you have created a marvelous video called Dancing with Gaia. And this is right now it's available from your website, right?
Right, yeah, Dancing with Gaia.
Right. Yeah, and this would... If you're, you know, for those listening who are really, really, who are fascinated by what we're seeing, and I would hope you would be, that you want to really get an idea of what Ferroferia was and meet Fred and Svetlana in rare footage of the two of them, and all this is an excellent introduction. And you have a nice, beautiful booklet that goes along with the film, too, that helps introduce Ferroferia. Tell us how we can get a hold of that and just go ahead and don't feel like it's shameless self-promotion because this is something people need to have. This is something we need to get out. Yeah.
Okay, I'll say it, but I'll keep it brief. DancingWithGaia.com is where we have the film, and there's a trailer there. You can get the idea of what the film is more or less like with the trailer. And the tab on the far right at the top tells you exactly how to, you know, press the right buttons to obtain the film. And the other thing that we've been working on really hard and is now available is we have our wonderful book called Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Ferroferia Path. And that is in a form right now where you can purchase. It's a beautiful hardbound book with, you know, thick glossy pictures and lots of Fred's art and a wonderful introduction to Ferroferia, explaining sort of the basic beliefs and background and history and the deep roots of Ferroferia in Crete and Eleusis and the various other parts of the world that gave strong inspiration to Ferroferia. So that's, let's see, not on, that's actually at ferroferia.org as opposed to, it's not on dancingwithgaia.com. It's at our own website, way over again on the right, I think it is. You can find the tab where you can pull it down and see the little purchase now button. You can get it with PayPal or a credit card. And the thing about this book is it's kind of expensive. I think it's $69.95, but it's an amazing book. It's an art book, and I'm actually to the point now where I'm going to actually not print any more copies of it because the printer has raised their price, and so that I'm you know to the point where I'm almost going to be losing money just to get more copies of it from this particular printer. So we're going to make a new edition. It'll be smaller, and it'll I'm sure be quite lovely too. But there's a limited number of these still available. There's about a dozen left. So those of you who feel really motivated can get one of the remaining copies of it. It's a really really beautiful book, and the images are great for just meditating on. But I also wanted to talk about just another aspect of Ferroferia, which gives me a lot of inspiration, which has to do with sort of the future that you might say, you know, what is the Ferroferian vision of the future? Fred wrote an article. It was a long 5-part article. It appeared in his Corythalia newspaper, an article called The Ecology of Paradise, and then there were some sort of spin-off articles that described, you know, what is paradise and, you know, the different aspects of it and how it all fit together. But what was good about this article is it gets into the kinds of ways that people can work towards, you know, a Fairfarian vision of the future, starting with creating your own henge, your own circle like we have in our own yard, just a little tiny stone henge, you know, like don't get intimidated by the word henge. It doesn't mean it has to look like the stone henge we all think of in Britain. Just a stone circle with the eight markers for the eight positions, north, south, east, west, and the cross quarters. And then that's described really clearly, by the way, in that book, and I believe there's descriptions of that on our website as well. And that becomes your central focus of what you might say outdoor worship, or bringing all the energy of the land into your own home and your own outdoor temple. And it can be really simple. It can be something you can make your circle with, just something temporary like stones that you temporarily put into a position. If you don't have land that you can work with, like that you can leave up all the time, you can create something temporary and then, you know, create it again. It doesn't take that long. If you have a compass, it's fairly easy and straightforward. And when you have this, you can call in the fairies, you can, you know, do the seasonal rituals, and you can sit there and meditate. You can watch the stars wheel by and make positional markers to show where the, for instance, where the sun rises on summer solstice and winter solstice and, you know, fall and spring equinoxes. You can mark like the special positions that the moon goes to when it goes to its north and south nodes, which it has done an 18.6 year cycle of where it appears in the night sky when it arises, going further north and then eventually further south. So there's many celestial events that you can mark, and also there are ways that are described in the book and, you know, further in the articles to work with the stars themselves, the stars of the zodiac, the constellations, to have a more intimate relationship. For instance, some people have a real strong connection with the Pleiades, like I happen to do. And I don't know why I've got this connection, but boy, every time I see the Pleiades, it's like a little zing. It just goes right into me. And so I feel like when I can see the Pleiades in the sky, like it's like things are good, you know, the world's in a good place. I've got a good relationship with the sky. And anyway, this circle is a place that you can kind of use as your sort of, you know, observing station. You can make note of certain things. You can put also on the edge of the circle, you can move a stone around to mark where you are in the year, because the east, for instance, is the springtime and the south is the summertime and so on. It's like a calendar, a circular calendar. And so if you make a little stone and have it, you know, mark and move it around the year, you're sort of watching events coming up and you're seeing them in a circular fashion as you move it around. You can put your own birthdays, you can markers for you, your birthday, you know, your loved one's birthdays, things like that, little special moments like an anniversary, and personalize your circle. And so it becomes more and more meaningful to you over time. And, you know, why am I making such a big deal about the personal henge? Because it's the center of your own mini-paradise. You start using this as a place to spend more and more time outdoors, and naturally, because of that, you're starting to, like, you know, pay more attention to your land. You're creating a more beautiful place around where you live. And you might even be moved to, as Fred recommended very strongly that people do, you know, buy a little ruined acre of land that's just far enough out of town that you can afford it, or maybe you and some friends can afford it, and restore it to its natural, you know, the kind of plants and trees and so on that were naturally in that environment before people came along and ruined it. And then you can put a little stone circle there, and it becomes the center of another little mini paradise. And over time, the idea is that, you know, people can spend time in these little wilderness paradises that they create and attract more people to become involved in this, and, you know, the process of reclaiming land and making it beautiful once more in its natural way encourages wildlife to start flourishing again. And it's like a way of gradually reclaiming land for the goddess. And so that's kind of our, you know, program, you might say, about how to save the world, is by creating these little paradisal sanctuaries.
Yeah, Fred was very much into ley lines and sacred geometry laid out on the landscape, and he had a whole network of sacred sites interconnected by geometric ley line patterns from Mount Shasta on down to Southern California, down to the Salton Sea, and various areas like this. He spiritualized the whole state of California in that manner, and just really this idea that he had of recovering the sacredness of the planet itself. You know, the idea that the old Renaissance idea, the anima mundi, the divine ensouled Earth itself, which of course is totally feminine. One of the things I want to stress, though, for people that are new to Farifaria and this broadcast, is that Fred Adams was a world-class surrealist artist. And he was a superb draftsman, and so his vision and his goddess orient, everything is oriented toward the divine feminine, but his artwork is absolutely breathtakingly beautiful. And this, in your book, of course, your Wildness of Nature book, this is what absolutely makes the book a treasure, is this marvelous artwork. And I just put in a little plug for our film Beyond Lemuria. We used quite a few of Fred's beautiful paintings and murals and all in that film. And you also have in even more in Dancing with Gaia, and the book is the book you mentioned is it's a treasure, because Fred's artwork is just really magnificent, and it harkens back to the post-romantic period of the French fin de sec era, you know, the symbolist painters,
right.
and Norman Lindsay, that wonderful neo-romantic painter back in the 20s, who rather shocked the Edwardian British curmudgeons were rather shocked by some of his pagan, lush pagan paintings, you know. And Fred was, of course, also very much influenced by Lindsay. But his artwork just has to be seen to be appreciated. We helped republish 9 Royal Passions of the Year. And this is a publication that Fred came out with back in 1968, and it was published by Elysium. And what it was is like a series of tarot cards for the 9 sacred ceremonies. And this is available both from the Church of the Hermetic Sciences and also from Periferia. And I remember I brought up a number of them for you. But 9 Royal Passions of the Year, I think it's a nice introduction, you know, and less expensive. It does relate as tableau or almost like I say, tarot card type art for each of the seasonal ceremonies, along with a description. Fred also was influenced by William Blake, and so Blake was a marvelous artist poet, but he also was the inventor of the the inventor of the comic book. But Blake did all of his. All of his text was all in his own calligraphy, and Fred did the same thing.
Right, in that particular,
Right. Would you want to talk a little bit about Fred's artwork? I don't want to be the only one talking about
it's
more
marvelous,
with it than
and
I am.
You know, the thing about art is, unfortunately, we can't really show samples of it here on your radio show, but. It is really, really inspiring, and I I don't know what to say beyond the fact that, you know, it's just incredibly beautiful, and a lot of it is full of symbolism, and, you know, a person can spend a long time looking at an individual image and, you know, discover more and more about it just because there's so much there. I mean, some of them are more straightforward, but there are certainly a number of them in the book that are, you know, just profound. You really can spend some time with them, and they're very beautiful. And like poetry pieces, only with visuals, right, because there's so much to them. I had another thing that I was very interested in kind of mentioning, because it's as I'm going through all this material, there's just so much, you know, with all the Corythalia was published for 5 or 6 years at least, and I think there were about 13 issues a year, so there's a lot of material to go through along with just all the written papers that I wound up with Fred. So there's a lot of it that still hasn't really been digitized, and it's an ongoing process. Fortunately, I've got some nice help with that, but one thing that I ran into that I just fell in love with only yesterday, I thought I would share it because it has to do with kind of the future and sort of where we are right now. I'll kind of describe it a little bit. It's a short article called The Orders of the Silver Boar and the Golden Bull Protect the Witch Queen of Wildness, Creag and Twerk. And there's a description of how this silver boar is a defensive totem of the night side of nature, guarding the threshold of the moon sphere. In Malakula, the curved boar's tusks gleaming from either side of its dark mouth are said to symbolize the waxing and waning moon, a piece of imagery far from fanciful to anyone who has met such a boar at dusk, when its dark body sinks into the general blackness and nothing is to be seen but the tusks reflecting every atom of light. That was written by John Layard in 1955 in an article called Boar Mythology. The silver boar is the totem animal, you might say, for some groups of people, in honor of the goddess of wildness and the defensive, you know, totem, as the golden bull is often seen as the defensive totem of the sun sphere. I'm drawing from Fred's article. So as he says, the witch queen of wildness is the divine lady of all wildlife. Those who wish to defend her in the battle of trees, the ecological Armageddon of our time, may serve under the banner of the silver boar or golden bull as their own fairy flame so inclines. The eco-tactics of the silver boar would include reforestation, emphasizing at first propagation and transplanting of moon-magical, smog-eating poplars and willows, eco-satire and surrealistic street theater, such as relating to ecological atrocities by going up with perhaps a gang of youth with whimsical clothing and overpowering an operator of a bulldozer with tickling and kisses and strange statements, things like that. And so then the eco-tactics of the golden bull, which would be different, right, would be more maybe left brain, filing injunctions and initiating legislation to rescue endangered landscapes and species, analytical communication of the causes and effects of population explosion, pollution, ecosystemic cleanups of erosion control measures and restoration of wetlands and forestry. So this was a wonderful article. I'll go ahead and make that available online at some point in the hopefully near future on our Fairfaria site. The phrase "Creag an Tuirc" means the boar's rock, and it was the rallying cry of the Scottish clan MacLaren, which is whence cometh the name MacLaren in Fred's name. So this was something I thought, you know, it's like this idea that people could gather together and these, you know, choose, okay, I'm going to be relating to the clan of the Order of the Silver Bear, and they could, you know, make it their personal mission to engage in some of these kind of, you know, somewhat lighthearted but still very much earth-sensitive activities. And, you know, it's more extroverted than, you know, maybe what we would be doing in our own Stonehenge or stone circle. You know, sometimes we do that with among just ourselves. So this would take us now or more out into the world and maybe be more visible, really.
Yes. Well, you know, where does this McLaren idea or the connection come from? Fred was related. Was he actually related to the clan McLaren? Cause,
yes.
Because I know he really was fascinated by it.
Oh, yeah. That was part of his name, actually.
Yeah, in
it
fact,
was,
well,
his extended name was Frederick Charles McLaren Adams, the third.
Yeah, right. And so he had a connection, too. Actually, did have a connection to the McLaren clan.
Right.
That's... Fred was one of the things that about Fred and Svetlana, both of them, that I just well, as I said at the beginning of the show, I was almost ready to give up looking for a master to anybody in the Los Angeles area who I thought really and of course that was before I met Rigardi. But when I met the two of them and talked with them, and saw their beautiful artwork and their beautiful home, I realized that these people are supremely cultured. They're supremely well educated in a deeper sense than just having degrees or something like that. These are culturally educated, refined, and supremely sophisticated people. And this aspect of Feraferia, this beautiful mythological the depth of learning and the depth of classical scholarship behind what they were doing is something that was frankly kind of missing in our explosion of esoteric yearnings back in the 70s. Fred and Svetlana, to use a crude term, they were a class act. You know what I mean? They were really a class act. I know that's a crude way to describe it, but they certainly were, and you and what you have preserved and continued is in that same vein and tradition, and so this is not no one should ever think that this is later day hippie stuff. No, the hippies kind of liked it, but. I didn't understand it a lot of times, and I just think that your marvelous efforts to preserve and prolong and contribute to this wonderful tradition, Joe, just really it warms the cockles of my heart and just continually inspires me, and I'm so glad that for whatever. You know, I have whatever I've aided you in doing. I not as much as I probably should have, but I'm so glad to have been able to be of assistance in preserving this and keeping it going and contributing to it, because it's a national treasure. It really is, and we should consider that it certainly is that. And frankly, I can't imagine anything in that coming from that era that can equal it. As I said in the abstract to begin with, Feraferia is the oldest, most elegant, and sublime expression of American neo-pagan goddess-centered nature religion. And I think after listening to you describe this and after our discussion tonight, perhaps we have introduced this wonderful tradition to some new people. I hope so.
I hope so, too. Thanks so much for letting me be on your show. It's a real pleasure.
Well, you're always welcome. In a kind of a way, because Feraferia and OTA are so close together, and we've been so much inspired by Fred Svetlana's work, that you can always consider it your show too. You know, I mean, and so thanks again for for coming on. Thanks for, and thanks especially for having us up there and letting us share that wonderful ceremony. Now, next week, let me ask my wonderful producer here, as far as Andrea, who is, what do we have on tap for next week, or what? Well, we don't know. All right, we'll have something. We'll have something that perhaps not quite as dynamic as what we have tonight, but we'll have something good on next week. And so, meanwhile, good magic to everybody, and Emily Corey, Emily Kouros, Aouya, and thank you, Joe. Bye-bye.
Thank you.